When you ask a scientist why they're doing something, the answer is likely to be short and pretty self-assured. Because we can. Or because the work answers some specific challenge that we've set out. But ask a philosopher that same question, the why, and the answer is more likely to meander. Our guest today brings the two worlds of science and philosophy together to help us get a handle on the questions that science just can't answer all on its own. He's written a book called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. In it, we step back from the particular achievements of science to examine the broad significance of inquiry. In the process, we acquire the tools for telling rigorous science from snake oil sales. Our guest is a philosopher and a professor of philosophy of science at the Cambridge University in England. He's the author of many books on biology and bioethics, including Cultural Evolution, Darwin, Organisms and Artifacts, and Risk. He contributes to the London Review of Books and the Times Literary Supplement, among others. Today, he joins us by phone from his home across the Atlantic. Tim Lewins, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure to have you here. I don't believe I've ever interviewed a philosopher of science before. On the whole, how does this field depart from its constituent individual parts, science and philosophy?
I don't think there's that much difference. Philosophers of science basically are interested in asking the deepest questions that we can about the sciences. And so that means that we need to learn a good amount about the sciences themselves. But typically, philosophers of science also have a background of general philosophical interests as well.
So Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman famously is said to have said that the philosophy of science is about as useful to scientists as ornithology is to birds. How do you respond to this challenge?
Yeah, okay. So Feynman, as you say, didn't seem to be very impressed with philosophy. I think that there are a couple of things to say to Feynman. The first one is that Feynman is assuming that the only thing that could make the philosophy of science valuable is if it turns out that philosophers of science are good at helping scientists do their job better. And clearly Feynman thought that we weren't able to help scientists do their job better. Now, I actually disagree with that because I think that a lot of scientists themselves turn out to be interested in questions that, if they don't, even if they don't recognize it, questions that have a kind of philosophical component. So you see this in a lot of disputes around biology, for example, biologists disagreeing about whether or not evolution is fundamentally all about genes, or whether instead you should think of evolution as acting at different kinds of levels of organization. You see it when biologists disagree about what kinds of things species are, and they don't solve those problems by going out and doing more experiments. They solve those problems by having a rich conceptual discussion. And in that sense, they're already engaged in philosophy, whether they realize it or not. But the other thing to say about Feynman's position is that he's just assuming that the only thing that could make a discipline valuable is if it makes scientists better at doing their jobs. But there are plenty of things philosophers of science can do that are useful, but that don't necessarily contribute directly to scientific activities. So we can help people understand what the right role of science should be in policy decisions, for example.
Right. It seems like philosophy can create some inconvenient truths for scientists, or maybe some things that they have to consider outside of the parameters of, say, the scientific method. What kinds of problems do you see arise when scientists try to discount philosophy in their work, as Feynman did?
Well, I think there are a few things we can say about that. So one very obvious area comes about when governments, for example, are trying to deliberate about what they should do about new technologies. And quite often, the very understandable response that comes from government is, we need to put together a panel of scientific experts who can give us a report on the wisdom of, and then insert whichever new technology it is that you might be interested in. It might be a new technology for helping women to have babies. It might be a new technology for extracting energy from the environment. And often the way in which those reports are framed is that the thought goes that we're going to take a piece of purely objective, entirely value-free scientific advice and then see how we can fit that into the democratic process. Now, a lot of philosophers, and I'm one of them, are quite skeptical about that way of understanding the role of scientific advice. It's very, very hard to see how a scientist can make an effective contribution to policy without also taking a stand themselves on some of these evaluative issues. So one way in which we deal in inconvenient truths, I think, is that we alert scientists to the ways in which it's hard for them to claim certain kinds of objectivity, certain kinds of value freedom.
Right. Bias in science, I think on an ideal scale, the scientific method is supposed to be something that winnows out bias. What is the scientific method to you?
Well, that's a funny question. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. One thing, I'm not sure it's so obvious that in an ideal world, scientists are going to somehow make communications to government which are completely free of value. The reason why I say that is because if a government is in the business of putting together a scientific panel that's supposed to, let's say, decide whether or not the evidence is in yet to mean that it's safe to go ahead with maybe a new form of IVF or something mm-hmm. like that. If government asks that question of scientists, my view is that it's very, very hard for scientists to contribute to that debate at all unless they implicitly or explicitly take some kind of stance on values. Because a scientist can't just provide government with literally every single piece of information. The scientist also has to decide whether or not enough evidence has come in yet for government to decide whether or not to go ahead with this technology.
Go ahead.
And it's very, very difficult for scientists to make that kind of decision without also deciding something about the consequences for real people of these technologies. And so in that sense, scientists always have to engage in an evaluative discussion.
Right. It sounds like it's putting a lot on scientists to not only decide what's true, but also decide what to do with that information or how advocacy around it should look afterwards. We're talking today with Tim Lewins about The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. That's the title of his new book. We will be back with Tim Lewins and your phone calls and emails, number and address on the way after a short break on the Jefferson Exchange. With your host today, that's me, Emily Curitan. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Emily Curitan. Our guest today is Tim Lewins. We're talking about the meaning of science and how philosophy and science interact with one another. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Phone number is 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Also on Facebook, Jefferson Exchange, or on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. Now, Tim Lewins, we were just talking about what is incumbent upon scientists when they present their work. I think in your field, a philosopher of science, you're often called upon to tell us the difference between science and quackery. Is that something that we can do by drawing a straight line? Could we play a game where I, you know, call something out and you tell me if it's science or pseudoscience, or is it more subtle than that?
I think it's surprisingly hard to come up with a one-size-fits-all measure that allows you to say, yes, this is science, no, this is pseudoscience. Having said that, though, I do think, funnily enough, that if you do come up with kind of specific instances, there's plenty that philosophers of science can say about it might be intelligent design theory, it might be astrology, it might be homeopathy. There's plenty we can say about the standing of those subjects, and there's plenty of a critical nature that we might say about the standing of those subjects. It turns out, I think, that we often need slightly different tools to say what's good or what's bad about each of those different disciplines. It's hard to find just one answer that works for them all.
So the things you just named, intelligent design theory and natural medicine, economics, I'm not sure if you named it yet, but what do all those things have in common other than maybe being kind of shuffled off to the side of pseudoscience?
Yeah, so that's pretty much it. I mean, the main thing that they do have in common is that they occasionally come in for criticism. Economics is maybe a bit of an outlier there, because some people think that economics is a perfectly respectable activity. Other people are rather skeptical about whether or not it's a science and whether it's actually a kind of politics dressed up as science. I mean, the most famous effort to try to give a general account of the difference between science and pseudoscience comes from Karl Popper, a Viennese philosopher of science who then spent a lot of his career in Britain. And Popper basically said that the difference between science and pseudoscience was that science always sticks its neck out. The mark of science is that it makes very, very firm commitments about what is or what is not going to happen. And in that sense, Popper said that real science exposes itself to serious experimental tests. Now, Popper's views, I think, are plausible. I do think there are some problems with them, but the way in which you can see that they're plausible is that Popper would say, well, you know, the general difference between, for example, astronomy on the one hand and astrology on the other hand is that an astronomer will say, okay, this is when a comet is going to arrive. And if the comet doesn't arrive, then at least Popper's view was, so much the worse for the theory. This shows that your view about the universe has been falsified. Astrology, on the other hand, Popper said that the problem here was really that astrologers never really say in any great detail what's going to happen. And because of that, they never really put their theories up for test. So the kind of claim that you get usually in an astrologer's newspaper column says something like, bad luck next week may bring disappointment. Well, you know, the astrologer hasn't told you you're going to have bad luck. They've just told you what might happen if bad luck arises. And it's pretty obvious that if bad luck arises, you'll be disappointed. So nothing that the astrologer has really said here commits them one way or another to what's going to happen. And so that's one of the most famous efforts that we have at sketching a general account of the science-pseudoscience distinction.
Now, in Karl Popper's lifetime, he was around for most of the 20th century. What are some high-profile examples that challenged or confirmed his notion that a good scientific theory, a real scientific theory, sticks its neck out there and asks people to disprove it if they can or if they dare?
Okay, so one of the best examples, and this was one of Popper's own real kind of motivators, I think, behind his theory, were the spectacular confirmations that Einstein's relativity theory saw in the early part of the 20th century. So Popper had a background set of suspicions. Popper thought that things like, you know, Newton's views, Einstein's views, those were real science for him. Things like Freud's view of the mind, Karl Marx's views about history, astrology certainly, Popper thought that those things didn't really count as genuine science. And just to give you a couple of sort of anecdotal illustrations of why you might think Popper was right about this, it turns out, for example, that Einstein's theory made very specific predictions about the ways in which light coming from distant stars would be bent by the gravitational force of the sun. And so there was an expedition which set out to confirm this bending phenomenon. And it had to happen during an eclipse, because it's only during an eclipse that the bright light coming from the sun itself doesn't obscure all the observations that you want to make of the bending of light from more distant stars around it. And it turned out that Einstein's views were beautifully confirmed. So here Popper thought that we've got a very clear prediction, and lo and behold, Einstein's theory passes the test. Now, on the other side, a case where Freud, for example, is shown to be distinctly slippery.
Uh-huh.
Freud himself gives an example. He says Freud has this view of so-called wish fulfillment. So Freud's theoretical idea goes, during our dreams, we live out our deepest desires. So we see those deepest desires made reality in our dreams. We see our wishes fulfilled in that sense. That's the basic theoretical claim. And then one of Freud's patients says to him, well, what are you going to make of this one, Sigmund? She says, I had a dream the other night, and it's not something that I deeply desired to do at all. In fact, it's something that I've always had an absolute horror of. I had a dream that I went on holiday with my mother-in-law. And she says, going on holiday with my mother-in-law is the last thing in the world that I want to do. I can't stand the woman. And so Freud then says, okay, so how am I going to fit that observation into my theoretical framework? And he does this move that appears to be unbelievably slippery. Freud says, well, I think that, in fact, this woman's deepest desire was to show my own theory refuted. She wanted to prove me wrong. And lo, in her dream, she did indeed prove me wrong by having a dream that was at odds with my own theoretical pronouncements. Now, it's not hard to see why, in the face of a kind of distinction like that, Popper wants to say, Einstein is exposing his theory to honest test. Freud, on the other hand, has a theory that's so elastic that it can just stretch around any observations that you want, and it's never really exposed to a test at all.
Now, is it possible that perhaps the world is comprised of truths that are just that different from one another, where we have certain, and again, this gets to the question of if science is really beholden to truth, even to the extent that philosophy is, but you know, when you're trying to come up with a set of laws to describe the universe, perhaps they need to be governed by different premises than a set of laws governing the human mind. And do your philosophies of science allow for that kind of distinction, or is it all debate, all or nothing?
Well, I think that the point that you're making there does get to one quite serious problem with Popper's views. Sometimes I think that it's perfectly reasonable for a scientist to fail to make precise predictions. It's perfectly reasonable sometimes for a scientist to say, do you know what, I couldn't quite handle that phenomenon, but maybe that's just because I need to rejig my theory a little bit. You see this very clearly in the biological sciences, for example, and this is something that derives precisely from the fact that the biological world is extraordinarily complex, it's extraordinarily badly behaved, there are random mutations introduced into evolutionary processes all the time, the precise direction that evolutionary processes take is dependent on very fine-grained facts about exactly which population of birds happen to land on which island at what time, therefore exactly how their evolutionary trajectory is going to move away from that specific idiosyncratic population that happens to settle on that island. All of that means that the biological sciences are really bad at making clear predictions. But the fact that they're bad at making clear predictions derives in large part from the extreme complexity of the subject matter that they're dealing with. So I think that we need to take into account exactly this issue about the diversity of processes that we see in the universe around us. And that also drives us, I think, to hold back a little bit from making very, very general pronouncements about what's science and what isn't. It turns out that, no, the biological sciences are not especially good at coming up with precise predictions. But that doesn't mean that they're not scientific. It just means that they're dealing with a set of phenomena which are in themselves very, very hard to predict.
Right. It makes sense that the science of life would be a little bit messy, like its subjects. We're talking today with Tim Lewins. His new book is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. So much material in here. Your comments and questions are more than welcome. Phone number 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. You can like us on Facebook and message us there. Look for Jefferson Exchange on Facebook. Now, Tim Lewins, we've got an email here from one of our listeners, Matt. He is asking if you could respond to the commonly held creationist critique that science is a belief structure, like any other, requiring that of the same sorts of faith commitments as a religion or a supernatural belief structure would.
Well, I think it's really important here to be clear on what we mean by belief structure. I mean, of course, scientists have views about the structure of the world. Scientists have the view that water has the molecular structure H2O. Scientists have the view that the species that we see around us are descended from a small number of common ancestors. So, sure, in that case, if you want, you can say that this is a belief, but it's a belief that's based on many, many decades, in some cases, many, many hundreds of years of rigorous experimental work. So, yes, it's a belief, but that doesn't mean it's just a belief. That doesn't mean it's founded on faith. I think it's one of the hallmarks of scientific belief that scientists are always willing to take a highly fallible attitude to what they do. They're always willing to give up their views in the face of tricky experimental results. And so in that sense, it's not quite right to think of sciences as just another belief system or just another system of faith.
Mm, and I think Matt's question for me gets to another topic umbrella I wanted to cover with you today. And that's not just what is and isn't science, but the nature of scientific inquiry over time. I'm thinking of this in my mind as the way we'll perhaps couch history as a progressive pursuit undertaken by rational beings, and everything is getting better all the time. And we hear that same language applied to science. It's an achievement, a breakthrough. We've won the battle, that kind of a thing. Do you study folks who see science as progress or, on the other hand, as cyclical?
Right. So one of the key issues that philosophers of science work on is precisely this question of how are we supposed to understand the whole historical sweep of the sciences. Philosophers of science are pretty much universally respectful and highly impressed, indeed awed, by scientific work. But that doesn't answer the question of exactly how we're supposed to interpret the achievements of scientists. So on the one hand, there's a view that's usually called scientific realism, and this is the view that the sciences make progress over time, and they make progress towards an increasingly accurate representation of the most fundamental nature of the universe. Now, in the way that we read newspaper science columns, you might think that this is obviously the right view to have about science. But there have historically been, and there still are, a lot of alternatives to that scientific realist view. So, for example, some people take the view that the history of science is a history of heroic and remarkably impressive failures. So time and time again, theories which we think are doing a wonderful job get rejected by later scientists. Newton gets replaced by Einstein. Earlier views get replaced by Darwinian theories. Darwin's theory itself has been challenged in some ways in recent years. And so there the thought goes, if you're putting money on what's going to happen in the future, you should put money on our modern scientific theories being rejected by future scientists as well, with the result that, in fact, we shouldn't think of our own theories as reliably telling us about profound truths. Instead, we should just think of them as useful tools for prediction, but which we'll ultimately jettison, just as every generation of scientists has jettisoned what went before them.
It made me think there of what can happen, though, when perhaps two at one point unrelated theories end up getting married to each other in an arena like public policy or a common understanding. When you said Darwinism and thinking of theories of capitalism that have married this idea of the origin of the species and the selection of certain traits, does that do something to the robustness of fallibility? Not to use too many $10 words in a row, but you know, when you put your chips on an idea, and then that idea maybe proves to be false in one arena, but it's already become the basis of an economic system, you can't quite disentangle as easily, which seems to me.
Yeah, so there's an irony to that. And the irony is that it's not a new thing that Darwinian theories have been put to work in explaining the workings of capitalist marketplaces. It was right there at the beginning. So Darwin himself, we think of Darwin as a natural historian. We think of Darwin as a biologist. Darwin made a lot of money, and he didn't make that money primarily through sales of his books. He certainly didn't make that money because he had an academic salary. He never had a professional academic job in his life. Darwin made a lot of money through speculation. He held shares. He lent money. Darwin was a rich man thoroughly steeped in Victorian capitalist thinking. And it's partly because of that that when Darwin himself looked around the natural world, he viewed that world through capital-tinted spectacles. He looked around and he saw division of labor. He saw specialization. He saw species opening up new markets and thriving because of that. So the whole marriage between capitalist thinking and evolutionary thinking was right there at the beginning. But I don't think that means there's anything wrong with it at all. I don't think you can use that to undermine Darwin's views, unless you also think that there's some terrible mistake Darwin has made here. But that's not remotely clear.
Yeah, that's my question, is do you think that that was a bias or an insight, or can they both be acting simultaneously in the same way?
So I think that the best way to think about this is Darwin's capitalist views, meaning that he's particularly receptive to viewing nature in a certain kind of way. He's particularly receptive to thinking of nature in terms of competition between individuals for resources. And once he starts seeing it in that way, a whole load of insights immediately open up to him. And that's a positive feature of Darwin's theorizing, it seems to me. So in that sense, I think that we can say perfectly reasonably that Darwin's theorizing was affected by his political and economic thinking, but not in a way that undermines it, in a way that simply explains why Darwin was able to see things that other people hadn't seen.
Seeing things in a different way is the topic of the hour with our guest Tim Lewins, The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. I'm your host, Emily Curitan. We will be opening up the phone lines for the final segment on the other side of a short break. Phone number and email address are on the way. Thanks for listening to the Jefferson Exchange. On the Jefferson Exchange with our guest today, Tim Lewins. He's a philosopher of science at Cambridge University in England and the author of many books on biology and bioethics. His latest is called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. Presents a 30,000-foot view of the questions science can't answer and how philosophy and science need to work together. You can join this discussion. In fact, it's rather dry without you. Please join us at 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Tim, we've been talking about different ways that we can think of what is and isn't science and the nature of science. Sometimes something people come up with a theory and it's applied and it's very, very useful for a given number of years, maybe centuries. Is something true just because it's useful, or does it tend to be true when it's useful?
It's not true just because it's useful, but you're right. The question is whether or not it's being useful is a good indicator that it's true. And that touches on, I guess, one of the really kind of thorny issues around the philosophy of science. So for decades, philosophers have struggled over this issue. On the face of it, you know, many people have thought it's just obvious the best argument for why science is true is just that it works so well. How on earth could we use a theory to send people to the moon unless that theory was accurate? How on earth could we use science to design new drugs unless the science in question was accurate? But then at the same time, the opponents of that argument respond and they say, well, actually, as it turns out, we've sent people to the moon using Newton's theories, and we don't think Newton's theories are correct anymore. They're useful, but false. Or they say, it turns out that we design new drugs just by trying out a lot of things at random, and eventually we find something that works pretty well, and then we test it and market it. But we never really know how it works. And so it turns out that you can generate very, very useful things, but having no idea at all about how things work at a fundamental level. So that issue is one that has really raged in the philosophy of science. My view, for what it's worth, is that if a theory is useful, in the end, that is a pretty good indicator that it's true. But typically, when it makes a series of brand new predictions that nobody thought to look for anymore, that, I think, is an indicator that the theory is latching onto reality.
Let's take some calls here. We've got Ed in Ashland on the line. Ed, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. For some years, I've been savoring a book of called The History of Science in Ancient China by Charles Needham. Are you familiar with that?
Charles Needham or Joseph Needham?
Oh, it's Joseph. You're right.
Guess that's a ding, ding, ding. All right, Ed, what's your question?
Well, I just, it's one of his theses is that is trying to discover the reason that China progressed so rapidly in ancient times and then seemed to lose the battle of science to the West. And he suggests that it might have something to do with Confucianism or Buddhism, the influence on Chinese science, and also that they had never really invented experimental science and instead relied on a sort of an anecdotal gathering of facts in ancient China.
All right, Ed, thanks for those views. Let's give Tim Lewins a chance to respond.
I'm no historian of Chinese science, but one of the central questions that Needham kicks off is precisely what's now, it's actually become known as the Needham question. So roughly speaking, how come the scientific revolution happened in Europe and it didn't happen in China? And Needham adds, you know, after all, it's not as though the Chinese were no good at technical innovation. The Chinese themselves managed to invent gunpowder. They managed to hit on a whole variety of really central innovations. And yet the scientific revolution happened here in Europe rather than over there in China. There are a variety of different answers given to that. One of the ones that I find intriguing, partly just because it was posed hundreds of years before Needham himself posed the question, is an answer that we owe to David Hume, the famous Scottish philosopher. And Hume gave a kind of social and political explanation for this. He said, well, one of the things that explains why this happened in Europe but not in China is that Europe is divided into small communities which are nonetheless linked by trade in spite of the fact that they're highly diverse. Whereas China, on the other hand, had this gigantic, monolithic, bureaucratic, imperial structure. And so Hume basically said what you got in China was a kind of monoculture for knowledge. Everybody tried to do everything in precisely the same way because that's what everybody was told to do. Whereas in Europe, you get a huge number of different experiments going on in different countries, but then at the same time, the trade networks mean that if something takes off and is viewed as impressive in one location, it can spread pretty quickly around Europe more generally. So I rather like Hume's way of explaining this because it kind of brings a social and political domain to understanding how knowledge travels and how it's generated.
It seems like there certainly is a social and political domain. I wish that knowledge could travel in the vacuums that experiments are so often constructed in. We've got a number of calls here. Let's go to Al and Eugene. Al, thanks for calling The Exchange. You are on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My question to your guest with regard to theories, my understanding or what I think is that theories reflect our understanding of a matter. So if we understand a matter in a shallower way, we'll design theories that will fit to our understanding, or that's how our perception will receive it. Now, if we go deeper into understanding something, we'll probably have a different theory that will make the shallower ones obsolete. I remember reading a book by Fritjof Capra called The Tao of Physics, where he spoke of, we have a theory about the atoms and the different levels of electrons around the atom, around the nucleus. And he was saying there is no such a thing. It's just the electrons mainly like a cloud that going around the atom, and the speed of this cloud reflects the hardness of matter. I would like to have his comment about that.
Thank you, Al.
I think that you're absolutely right that often what scientists are doing is they're looking for theories at increasing levels of profundity. Where I would disagree is that this doesn't always mean that a theory then renders the earlier theories obsolete. So let me just give you a very quick example to illustrate what I'm talking about. Charles Darwin wanted to be what he called a philosophical naturalist. Now, that didn't mean a naturalist who also does philosophy. What that meant was a naturalist who isn't just happy to give a catalogue of different species, their habits, their anatomy, and their physiology. It was also somebody who, in addition to doing that, wanted to give some kind of deep explanation for why it is that species have the distribution they do, why they have the makeup that they do. And so what that meant was that when Darwin proposed his views about evolution, he thought that he'd given a really wonderful underlying theoretical explanation for why it is that, for example, the whale, the badger, and the bat all have remarkably similar limb structures, in spite of the fact that they use them for very different purposes, swimming, digging, and flying, respectively. So what Darwin did was he gave this underlying theoretical explanation, but it didn't render earlier theories obsolete. For example, it didn't render obsolete an awful lot of good natural historical work that people had done that simply demonstrated what the anatomical structures of these different species were. It took that work, and then it reorganized it and reinterpreted it, but it didn't deny it or throw it away.
Oh, very interesting. I'm thinking back on our discussion of Darwin today and wondering if a rich guy in Victorian society or any human can approach the question of why empirically the same way you can approach these more descriptive elements of scientific inquiry, you know, testing, does something have A, B, or C? We do have a lot of calls here, though, so I'll put my own curiosity in the back seat. Let's go to Tim in Eureka. Tim, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air with Tim Lewins.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, please.
Tim,
what's your question?
I'd love to hear you talk about the philosophy of the null hypothesis and why randomization is used in science.
Okay, well, I guess the main reason for why one might want to use randomization in science, I mean, just a very kind of quick example. It's most obvious in drug trials. So suppose you've got a new drug and you want to find out whether it works better than the drug that you've already got. What you want to do is test it on a group of people. But, of course, it would be terrible if you tried out one group of people with the drug, you tried out another group of people with sugar pills, but it turned out, unknown to you, or maybe known to you, that the group of people that you tried the drug on were 10 times healthier than the group of people that you tried the sugar pill on. Because if you do it that way, then you'll look at those super healthy people and you'll think, oh, you know, I give those people the drug and they're much better off than the people I gave the sugar pill to. But of course, that doesn't indicate anything about the powers of the drug versus the powers of the sugar pill. It's just that you happen to test the two things on very, very different populations. In the first case, you tested them on healthy people. In the second case, you tested them on people who weren't so healthy. So randomization in that sense, where you simply take groups of people chosen entirely at random, and you give one randomly chosen group of people your experimental drug, and you give another randomly chosen group of people your sugar pills, by choosing at random, the idea goes you increase the chances as far as possible that the two populations are relevantly similar, that any kind of bias or any kind of confounding effects will be cancelled out by randomization. At least that's the idea behind randomization there.
We've got time for one more call here. Let's go to Matthew in Medford. Thanks for calling the Exchange. You're on the air with Tim Lewins, author of The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science.
Hi. I'm regularly confounded by the sort of political cloud through which Americans perceive and use science. And I just wonder if a scientific philosopher might see a way out of that sort of clouded perspective on science in the United States.
All right. Thanks for that, Matthew.
Are you referring to a particular set of issues, or are you thinking about climate change in particular, or are you thinking more generally?
All right, go ahead, Matthew.
I emailed in earlier about the belief structure question. I have a Tea Party relative who's always hitting me with these, like, very cogent arguments against science. And, you know, I don't know, I'm sort of a lay scientist, and I'm a lay religious participant as well. And so I have these sort of baseline understandings of both belief structures, or, I guess, based on your response earlier, one belief structure, or traditions, maybe. And I'm just trying to bring those two traditions together in my own, you know, personal social network. And I wonder if in our sort of polarized society, there's any way that we can have those two traditions talk to each other in a coherent way.
Well, one reason why I think I'm quite pessimistic is because often when a debate becomes polarized, it often becomes characterized by certain kinds of conspiracy theory, for example. And one of the real worries about conspiracy theories is that they are, so to speak, self-sealing. So what that means is that if you're already the kind of person who thinks that the United Nations and climate scientists are involved in a giant conspiracy, for example, to ensure that, you know, various parts of America are increasingly subjected to overweening UN influence, for example. If that's your view, then when a sort of, you know, liberal left intellectual like me comes along and tries to claim that, you know, no, you shouldn't be worried, these scientists are all perfectly honest, they simply have people's well-being at heart, after all, look at all the wonderful experimental work that they've done, the problem is that it's very, very difficult for me to sound credible, because I'll just be placed in the conspiracy into the conspiracy theory as well. Mm-hmm. So gaining trust is actually the primary issue here, and the only way to do that is to somehow break down your social networks and eventually work as closely as you can with the very people that you don't trust in the first place.
All right, Tim Lewins, Trust, Science, and Philosophy. Thanks to all the callers for keeping it lively here on the Jefferson Exchange. And thanks to Tim Lewins for joining us to discuss his book, The Meaning of Science. Tim, thanks.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much, and thanks to your listeners.